Welcome to Science in Your Shopping Cart, a new series that shows how science touches many of the products you buy at the grocery store, from new varieties of fruits and vegetables to technological advances that make your food safer, cheaper, and tastier. I'm Todd Silver. I'm not a big shopper, especially when it comes to buying clothes, but I do appreciate style, and I like to wear clothes that fit well and are comfortable. Americans spend millions, maybe billions, on clothes every year. It's a huge industry, and when you think about clothes, do the words style, fit, and comfort come to mind? How about science and technology? Probably not, but science and technology play a major role in the textile industry. In this podcast, you're going to learn how ARS researchers developed non-yellowing wool, how we are creating a new line of cotton that's naturally fire-resistant, how we helped design military uniforms that had built-in protection against mosquitoes and ticks, how we found a better way to rate the quality of hides for leather products, and how we're creating new lines and new marketplaces for hemp. I call this episode Wearable Science. We begin with an innovation that could affect every living being, a wearable material that could one day help protect against COVID-19. We start our journey on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, Louisiana. Millions of people from around the world visit this famous strip to join the party that lasts all year long. The king of all parties is Mardi Gras, a carnival festival that runs from the day before Ash Wednesday until Fat Tuesday, well over a month. Music icon Elvis Presley once said, "You'll never know what heaven means until you've been down to New Orleans." Indeed, this is one of the most popular tourist attractions in the United States. And with such a heavy reliance on tourism, the Big Easy was hit hard from the shutdowns from the pandemic. According to New Orleans & Company, when the tourism industry shut down in mid-March of 2020, the city and its businesses lost more than $200 million per week in visitor spending. 3 years later, the miracles of medicine, along with proper guidance and public safety measures, have allowed popular destinations like New Orleans to reopen. But the pandemic is still here, and more needs to be done to protect us from this deadly virus and give us the confidence to safely socialize in popular places like Bourbon Street. ARS researchers here in New Orleans want to keep the party going by enhancing masks, clothing, and other wearable materials that help protect against coronavirus.
There are two components to this. One is a long-term interest that I have had in marrying wound healing science to cotton fabrics and bringing them into the 21st century since I arrived here at Southern Regional Research Center in 1997. We began working then on what were called smart wound dressings. Well, that was a long-term component of it. The short-term was when the pandemic associated with SARS-CoV-2 began. And of course, we all understand that that was threatening public health in a major way that really hadn't been seen since the Spanish flu. Using my background from having worked in pharmaceutical research and the development of molecules for the treatment of disease, I could see from some of the initial findings that there were some interesting properties of the way the virus binds to the host cell, with the theme being wearable sensors. That, of course, is something that numerous scientists have approached in the pandemic, as well as protective clothing, and we worked on protective masks during that time as well that were antiviral.
That's Dr. Vince Edwards, research chemist with the Cotton Chemistry and Utilization Research Unit in New Orleans. Edwards and his team previously developed cotton wound dressings for the battlefield that could actually aid in the healing process. Basically, he developed and applied antimicrobial properties to cotton fabrics to reduce the chance of infection in open wounds. He also discovered that unbleached cotton had natural properties that helped the human body heal faster. He applied these technologies to wound dressings, which have since been picked up by both the military and the healthcare industry. It also set the stage for his work developing wearable materials to protect against coronavirus.
There was a component of the protective fabrics that built on work that we had done to develop a dressing for battlefield use, and we found that treating this same dressing with very small amounts of vitamin C, we could elicit antiviral properties that were effective against COVID, SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Cotton is an ideal fabric for this technology because it's a natural material and consists of 99% cellulose, making it easy to modify. Most cotton clothing today comes from bleached cotton, but Edwards and his team have been working with unbleached cotton because of its natural antibacterial and antiviral properties.
We had begun to study the effect of these unbleached cotton fabrics to actually generate hydrogen peroxide, which is a molecule that plays a role in wound healing. It works well in healing wounds when it is generated at certain levels. And so we were studying that and found in the process that we could increase those levels of hydrogen peroxide by the addition of vitamin C to this fabric that was used on the battlefield to elicit these antiviral and antibacterial properties.
To understand how this unbleached cotton composition works in killing COVID molecules, we have to first understand how COVID attacks the human body. Speaking generally and trying not to be too technical, the COVID virus searches out and finds human host cells that it can then bind to or latch onto. The virus specifically searches out human cells of a particular shape. It's what Edwards calls a well-defined amino acid sequence. Once it binds to a human cell, it could then multiply and transmit its dangerous virus cells throughout the body. Instead of treating the body after infection, Edwards and his team looked to prevent the virus from infecting the body in the first place by tricking the virus. Here's what they did. They enhanced natural cotton with molecules called peptides, which are amino acids chained together, in this case to resemble a very small part of human cells. Actually, I'll let Edwards explain.
We found that the viral protein that sits on the surface of the virus was available commercially to scientists throughout the world to buy. Scientists throughout the world were ramping up work on this, so there were a lot of tools available early on in the pandemic that we could share and make progress towards understanding how to develop these types of molecules. Once we actually synthesized this molecule, it was a much smaller molecule than the protein it was taken from. It's something called a peptide, and we synthesized a series of these peptides and then studied them for their binding properties to the protein that is on the surface of the virus, the spike glycoprotein that gives its characteristic iconic features. That was basically how we got started on identifying molecules that would more optimally bind to the virus. And so having identified those, we found that molecules that had what we call a more helical shape actually bound better to the virus.
Spike glycoprotein is one of the largest structural proteins found in coronavirus. When you see a rendition of the coronavirus molecule and you see those spikes at the ends, that's the protein that helps attach to the host cells. Researchers found that the net positive charge on the spike glycoprotein increased as the coronavirus variants mutated. So, the original Alpha variant had less of a net positive charge than the Omicron variant.
This, in fact, we found interesting in that it could pose a possible way of modifying a textile to capture the virus simply through conferring a charge. In this case, one would make a negatively charged textile fiber.
Basically, instead of trying to create a peptide or protein that sat on the skin to ward off the virus, Edwards created peptides that could be placed on cotton materials, such as clothing and masks, that would attract the virus, bind to it, and then neutralize it. This technology is currently being tested on masks. to determine its effectiveness against different coronavirus strains. If successful, it could help communities reduce the spread of COVID, saving countless lives in the process. Meanwhile, back in the lab, Edwards and his team continue to work on what he calls intelligent textiles, which are clothing or materials that serve multiple purposes, such as providing viral protection or wound healing. During testing, Edwards attaches sensors to the cotton materials, and these sensors give off a color or fluorescence when certain destructive proteins from the wound binds to the wound dressing.
This is where you get into what we call intelligent textiles, where they're actually giving you some information about the environment that the textile is in, and then that information is transmitted via a signal to through telemetry, an iPhone or what have you. We've done work, as I said, on this with wound dressings, and there's other work going on and it's been quite successful in sensing molecules from sweat. Sweat contains glucose, electrolytes such as potassium and sodium, and lactate. The ability there with clothing that could in fact detect glucose levels in a, let's say, diabetic patient who needs to monitor their glucose levels for their own health care. And these types of sensors, called point of care sensors, and the area of point of care diagnostics is a rapidly growing field for the use of devices such as these.
Using this sensor technology, Edwards is currently testing a new era of battlefield dressings that address the issue of hemorrhage control as well as infection prevention.
We're working towards developing a dressing for prolonged field care that could be used to both control hemorrhaging and also prevent infection in scenarios where the soldier is in an austere part of the world in a very remote location where they cannot be evacuated for, say, 3 days or so.
Edwards' breakthrough research has gotten the attention of the military, textile companies, and the healthcare industry. There are tons of possible applications for this technology, from masks to wound dressings to diabetes care. He's also looking to embed his technology into cotton bed sheets to prevent bed sores, and incontinence pads and diapers to help prevent infections.
In this country alone, there are now 6 million patients who suffer from chronic wounds. 25 million Americans suffer from incontinence and bed sores. And then on the battlefield, half of all battlefield deaths result from hemorrhage. This is an area that we have really brought to the forefront of our research. There are now products as a result of our models on cotton fabrics that utilize our technology to address this problem.
Raise your hand if you like the cold. Okay, now raise your hand if you don't live up north and you still like the cold. I live in Maryland, a state that typically has four seasons and many different weather patterns. There's a saying in Maryland that if you don't like the weather today, don't worry, it'll be completely different tomorrow. Me? I was born in Southern California, and I still prefer warmth over cold. But living on the East Coast for many decades, I've learned to appreciate the cold, especially when it snows and I can click on my boots for a day of skiing. Off the slopes, I want to be warm, like cozy next to the fireplace warm. So I get it when I go out and see people looking warm and comfy in their wool jacket or wool sweater. Using sheep hair for warmth in clothing is nothing new. It's been done for thousands of years. Wool provides excellent protection not only from the cold, but wet weather as well. Wool is also a very durable fiber, so it can withstand the harsh winter elements as well as multiple washes. It's also flame resistant. According to the Oklahoma Department of Agriculture, wool-lined suits are worn by race car drivers to reduce their chances of being burned in a crash. Wool continues to be a significant commodity in the U.S. and abroad. Did you know that a single sheep can produce 8 to 10 pounds of wool a year? And 1 pound of wool can make 10 miles of yarn. Not only is wool functional and great at keeping the body warm, but it continues to be a fashion trend, especially sweaters and jackets made from natural wool fibers. A white wool sweater never seems to go out of style. However, the problem with wool is that it could yellow over time, especially when exposed to sunlight for long periods.
The yellowing has been a long-term problem for wool users. You buy a wool garment that's white, and you wear it for several years, and it's going to be yellow.
That's Eleanor Brown, researcher for ARS, who's now retired. Brown worked at ARS's Eastern Regional Research Center in Windmore, Pennsylvania, just outside the city of brotherly love. You may not know this, but many of the advancements in wool and leather clothing were developed right here in Windmore. We'll hear about our leather research later in the podcast. But for now, we're talking wool. And I promise not to make any bad father jokes about wool. Back to the yellowing of wool. This was a major problem for the industry because wool can yellow at any stage, even during processing. At the time, Brown and her team were developing enhancements to wool products, such as making them more fire resistant, and she used some of the same techniques to solve the yellowing issue.
We started on this back in the early 2000s. That's when transglutaminase became a big issue in terms of usage by a lot of different food industries. Transglutaminase is an enzyme which is produced mainly by fermentation, and it's used in the food industry to provide structure to foods. What it does is it catalyzes the formation of a bond between a glutamine on a protein or a peptide background and a primary amine. So it's good because it can hook a glutamine to a lysine and provide a stable bond that is not easily broken.
Basically, this process uses enzymes to bind food proteins together. It's a popular technique for processing cheeses, meats, edible films, even bakery products. Brown was curious if this binding process could also work with wool. Specifically, she wanted to attach para-aminobenzoic acid, or PABA, which was a common ingredient in sunscreens, to wool fibers. If PABA could protect human skin from the sun's harsh UV rays, then perhaps it could also protect wool fibers from the sun.
Since we knew that the wool tended to turn yellow when it was exposed to sunlight for a long time or heat, we wanted to see if we could protect it by attaching PABA. PABA is an amino acid structure type, so it had the appropriate functionality to be encouraged by the transglutaminase to react with glutamine on the protein. And of course, keratin being the main protein in wool, we wanted to see if we could attach that to the wool and protect it from yellowing when it was exposed to sunlight. And lo and behold, it worked.
The binding technology was so successful that the research center team used it in other projects to improve wool, including reducing itchiness. Why is wool itchy? Well, on the outside of wool fibers are cuticles, these scaly-looking things that provide a protective layer. Cuticles can make the wool's surface bumpy and rough, which in turn can irritate human skin. For this technology, ARS researchers used enzymes to remove some of the cuticles from the keratin proteins.
That was to smooth out the surface of the wool so that it diminishes the itch factor. And because it's bound onto it, it's more stable to laundry so that it doesn't wash off and you don't get a lot of felting.
To put this new technique to the test, ARS researchers collaborated with the U.S. military to furnish soldiers with itch-free underwear. I mean, if you really want to test out a fabric, there's nothing like enlisting the military to give it a good run.
That was fairly successful in their test runs.
With several major accomplishments under their belt, ARS researchers in Windmore are currently looking at new projects to improve wool and expand its value in the marketplace. One project involves turning elements of wool that are discarded during processing into a composite. That composite is then woven in with the wool fibers to create new natural materials that are strong and durable and can be used for much more than clothing.
They could go into things like films for packaging of food, clothing, whatever. But by themselves, without some form of strengthening material, are too fragile. We're actually looking at both the wool and the collagen from leather to see if we can make something which gives them strength.
Stay tuned to learn more about our successful projects coming out of Widmore. And in the meantime, don't be sheepish when it comes to staying warm. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. You may not know this, but the clothes you're wearing right now are probably flame retardant. That's because clothing manufacturers typically spray or embed their clothes with a chemical that provides a level of protection from fires or flames. The problem is, in addition to being a chemical composition, the protection is limited and can wear off after a number of washes. What if your clothes were naturally flame retardant and durable enough to still be effective after multiple washes? Well, that's just what ARIS researchers are striving for, and they may have achieved half their goal with this groundbreaking finding.
Every textile that we use has been treated with a chemical such that the flame will extinguish. And these new lines of cotton that we found, without any chemical treatment, have this property that they will self-extinguish. For some applications, this is a game changer, because you could imagine like a military uniform that has a blend of this cotton in it, where a small flame or ember lands on the service member, but just by simply slapping it, they can put it out. It won't rapidly consume the fabric. And the fact that it's not a genetically modified organism, it's made from a interesting but normal breeding process of other cotton lines that are already being cultivated, because they already have many of the traits that you would need to, or you would desire to, commercially grow cotton.
ARS has bred different lines of cotton for decades. There's a good chance that the cotton shirt you're wearing right now has a blend created by ARS researchers. Researchers like Dr. Gregory Tyson, who you just heard from, are developing new cotton lines that are stronger, more durable, and in this case, naturally flame retardant. Tyson works at the Cotton Chemistry and Utilization Unit in the Big Easy, and his latest research could indeed be a game changer for the textile industry. His four new lines actually came from 11 existing cotton breeds, and we'll get into that research shortly. But first, you need to check out the video of the test they conducted to assess the flame resistance of the new cotton material. Check it out in the description below. It's pretty wild.
You can see that the blowtorch used to ignite the fabric does make a hole in this improved cotton, but the improved cotton does not have any open flame, and actually it self-extinguishes. It does not burn all the way toward to the top of the test fabric, which is the measure. Once it gets to the top, the flame in the normal test will burn through a thread that will drop a weight that stops the timer. For normal cotton, and for all 11 of the parents of this population, in about 15 or 20 seconds, they will just burn through, and there will be a large flame that consumes the piece of test fabric. But self-extinguishing is a standard for flame retardants. You can put the blowtorch onto the fabric, but there's never an open flame.
This is a huge scientific development, but there are two caveats. First, this cotton line has successfully tested for being flame retardant, not flame resistant, which is a much higher bar. Cotton typically produces flammable fibers and is treated with chemicals to be flame retardant for consumer safety. Flame resistant materials are inherently resistant to catching fire, so the materials themselves do not catch fire. Flame-resistant materials are used in clothing for firefighters and in highly combustible materials like furniture, drapes, and carpets. The second caveat is this new cotton line still has a lot of research ahead of it to answer questions like sustainability, durability, and long-term effectiveness.
We need to figure out exactly what the compound is that these new cottons are making that is giving it that property. And then we need to figure out how durable that compound can stay in the cotton after washing it many times.
Still, this is a major research milestone. And like some of the greatest research breakthroughs of all time, like penicillin, it wasn't planned.
The population was originally created by Johnny Jenkins and Jack McCarty with the purpose of looking for agronomic and cotton fiber quality traits in a breeding program. The agronomic traits like stress resistance and yield, and the cotton fiber traits like length and strength and fineness.
Tyson and his team focused on 11 of ARS's most successful cotton lines, all of them quite diverse in their traits.
This was just, let's take 11 diverse cotton lines that are already good enough to grow and people grow them and see what happens when their genes get to be mixed together in every possible configuration. We began with a small study, but then it proved to be very promising that some of the lines in this population not only were more flame retardant than the parents, they were like dramatically more flame retardant than any of the parents. The phenomenon is called transgressive segregation, and the mechanism for producing it is synergistic epistasis. When you have a complicated population with many parents like this, the diverse genes from the diverse parents are given new opportunities to get together in ways that they never have before. So although all of the 11 parents burn like normal cotton burns, because there were these opportunities in this population for genes to interact in new ways, we were able to find plants that produced cotton fibers that did not burn.
Okay, that was a lot to digest, with some jargon mixed in for good measure. Transgressive means that it is outside of the norm of the parents. And segregation is talking about how the grandchildren of the breeding crop exhibit different traits. Synergistic epitasis occurs when a gene trait forms that is radically different from its parent gene traits. For example, it's like a mother who has blue eyes and a father who has brown eyes, and they have a baby with green eyes.
And that's the phenomenon of transgressive segregation, that you would think it should just be blue eyes and brown eyes and not suddenly something way past brown or way past blue. You would think, oh, maybe something in between. But it turns out that when you have enough of the diversity and a breeding program that mixes those genes together in enough unique ways, there is an opportunity for the plants to have traits that are beyond what any of the parents have. Sometimes when you look for something that you wouldn't really expect to look for and you find it, it's just amazing.
After making this discovery and testing its efficacy in small-scale combustion experiments, they selected lines that had the best heat release capacity and made textiles to conduct normal flame experiments. This took several years, and the results were very promising. There's much more research ahead, but Tyson is excited about the great potential of these new cotton lines.
It's a cotton that descends from and therefore also possesses the traits that growers and consumers expect out of cotton, but it also has this exciting and surprising new trait that most likely means that much less flame retardant chemicals will be necessary to achieve the safety that is required for most applications. And this will save growers and consumers costs and will reduce the environmental impact of the use of the amount of flame retardant chemicals to treat textiles as we use them today.
Tyson gives credit to longtime ARS researchers Johnny Jenkins and Jack McCarty, who developed the cotton population. He also praised ARS for fostering collaboration and providing resources such as people, technology, and most important, time to conduct such pioneering work.
I'm absolutely exhilarated by this and the potential that it creates. The opportunity to find something that wouldn't be expected and to have the resources to check every step of the way from dirt to shirt. We can use the diversity of the germplasm, we can collect the genomic analysis, we can make the fabric, we can test the fabric, and we can find something that nobody would have expected to find because we have the capabilities to look for it.
There's a common enemy among our brave soldiers, an enemy that's been part of every war and every conflict that we've ever traveled to. No matter where our soldiers travel, the enemy is there, and it can hospitalize, debilitate, and kill our soldiers without firing a single weapon. Although it can pack a mighty punch, this enemy can fit in the palm of your hand. The enemy I'm talking about here are arthropods, mainly ticks and mosquitoes. They can carry viruses and diseases that can cause illness in our soldiers. Illness plays a huge role when it comes to military readiness. Simply put, if you're not feeling well due to illness, you may not be physically or mentally fit for combat.
When you look at the history of all our military conflicts, the outcome has primarily been determined by non-battle combat injuries and deaths, things that are mostly associated with disease, and quite often it's arthropod-borne illnesses that are having an impact, especially when you do operations in areas where you don't have adequate mosquito and other insect control measures.
Mosquitoes and ticks can spread harmful, debilitating, and sometimes deadly viruses, including yellow fever, dengue fever, malaria, and Lyme disease. Some of these viruses are endemic to areas where our soldiers deploy, putting them at serious risk as soon as they arrive. We have some vaccinations to help protect against specific diseases, but we simply cannot vaccinate our soldiers against every mosquito-carrying disease. Canned spray repellents are useful, but soldiers are taught to be nimble and carry only the bare necessities with them.
In the real world, the time constraints, you got to get them in there. And so they're left with only what they can carry. And they're supposed to carry deep, but they don't always have access to it right away. But they always have the uniform. And the thought was, take one less complicating factor out and make it more passive in the sense that you have your uniform, you have to wear the uniform, the uniform's already been treated for you, you won't have to retreat, and you're ready to go.
That's Eric Bernier, a former national program leader for medical, veterinary, and urban entomology at ARS, who recently retired. Bernier spent most of his career at ARS working with the military to develop insect repellent treatments that could be applied to service member uniforms.
Clothing is normally worn on most of the surface of the body to protect the body when we're out in the environment, and that's the most logical choice, to put a repellent treatment into the fabric and protect us from getting bites, because as we've learned, we can still get bites through clothing as well as through the skin. Going back to the 1970s, the Department of Defense worked with ARS to work on clothing impregnates that would help keep mosquitoes, especially mosquitoes and ticks, from either attaching or crawling across the surfaces, in the case of ticks, but mosquitoes from biting through the surface of the fabric. And by 1991, it became standard issue to treat uniforms with permethrin in the field.
Permethrin is an insecticide that is considered safe and effective for application on garments, including clothing material for our soldiers. As Bernier mentioned, it's been used since the early 1990s, but its effectiveness tended to wear off on the fabric pretty quickly, especially when it's used in the field and when the garments were routinely washed.
In the 2000s, the Marine Corps started exploring alternative fabric treatments that are at least done in the factory level. So you produce the uniform with the treatment on it. That kind of got pushed a little bit more forward. In 2003, there was a mission to Monrovia, Liberia, to protect an airstrip out there, and Marines were deployed. I think there were 225 military personnel. 84, I believe, were medevaced out because of malaria. They were sent into a situation and not realizing that it was a heavy malaria incidence in that area. It's endemic, not protected well, concerned not only the safety of the soldiers, but the mission was scrapped.
It was around that time that the military challenged ARS to develop a technology to produce a safe, effective, and long-lasting mosquito repellent that can be applied directly to service member uniforms.
We accepted the challenge, went back through historically how the testing had been done, and discovered that there was a better way to come up with a way to evaluate these uniforms to make sure that we were assisting the Department of Defense and the treaters and manufacturers of those garments coming out the best, most protective uniform they could have.
Bernier and his team experimented with several repellents, including DEET, which was developed by USDA back in the 1950s, and it's still used today. The problem is, most repellents don't last on clothing, especially after many washes. Over time, their efficacy goes down.
There was a need to look at an alternative treatment that might last longer, as well as if you can find something that's even safer for human use, that's another objective. And the third one is, we are seeing increasing insecticide resistance in every facet of insect control.
Safe, effective, and long-lasting was the trifecta Bernier was searching for. And he found it in Etafenprox, a synthetic pyrethroid-like substance similar to permethrin. Etofenprox is typically used for outdoor and indoor foggers, for treating cracks in foundations to repel bugs, and as a spot-on pest treatment for cats and dogs.
You were overcoming one problem there. Its toxicological profile was better than permethrin. So you could safely have a greater dosage come in contact with human skin or other exposure, and you would end up with lower risk of any outcomes that are negative. What we found was that the etofenprox had a lower solubility in water. So when you wash etofenprox-treated fabrics, the etofenprox stayed in the fabric more so than permethrin did. So that lower solubility helped.
Bernier also found that applying etofenprox at a lower concentration compared to permethrin would still give you better, long-lasting protection. They tested the uniforms through 75 wash cycles, which typically exceeds the lifetime expectation of a field uniform. What they found was the protection level above 95% after the 75 wash cycles.
Which is amazing, because if you look at some of the other uniforms that were in use, like for the Army, the ACU has been the best, close to 100% protection through 50 wash cycles, but that's mainly because of the tightness of the uniform weave. When you have fabrics that are really tight, there's a lower probability of mosquitoes puncturing through the interstitial space between those fibers. So when we came out with the results, clearly that was the superior product.
In addition to military use, Bernier sees great potential applying etofenprox to civilian clothing, bed sheets, bed netting, and other uses. However, being able to keep our brave soldiers safe and healthy is what Bernier is most proud of when it comes to his research.
It's one of the most rewarding things I've done. And when I used to give talks on the subject, I would start and say, this is not, maybe not the most complicated science I've been involved with, but certainly the most rewarding in terms of protecting people with the potential to benefit civilians.
Time for a break. So if you need to do some laundry or put some clothes away, now's a good time. And while you're washing, folding, or ironing, check out these science breakthroughs from ARS. I love wearing jeans, especially when they can breathe and are comfortable. But jeans can sometimes be rigid and scratchy to the skin. ARS researchers in Clemson, South Carolina, created a cotton flax denim blend that makes jeans more comfortable to wear even in the summer. Flax is 2 to 3 times stronger than cotton, making it one of the strongest fibers known. We talked earlier about embedding insect repellents on military clothing to protect soldiers from disease-carrying mosquitoes and ticks. But did you know that ARS discovered and developed several insect repellents? These repellents were found to be very effective against pests, and were made from natural ingredients, such as honeysuckle, Q-fuel oil, cedarwood oil, and coconut oil. Check out our link to our Natural Products Utilization Research Unit in Oxford, Mississippi. Here's a great breakthrough for all you new parents. Back in the 1970s, ARS researchers in Peoria, Illinois, attached a synthetic polymer to starch molecules to create the Super Slurper. Now, this isn't a wonder straw for drinks. It's much more than that. Super Slurper is actually capable of absorbing hundreds of times its own weight in water. Super Slurper has found commercial life over the years in products as varied as seed coatings, wound dressings, and automobile fuel filters. But the starch binding technology behind the Super Slurper has led to new technologies and products, including more absorbent diapers for babies. Now that's something to smile about. Okay, back to the show. We're back in Windmore, at least virtually. Earlier in the podcast, we spoke with retired ARS researcher Eleanor Brown about the wool research conducted here at the Eastern Regional Research Center. This is where researchers developed wool clothing products that didn't yellow, that were fire resistant, and that were itch-free. But Windmore is also where a lot of ARS's leather research was conducted. The U.S. meat industry produces around 32 million hides each year, and most of those hides are exported for making leather jackets, pants, purses, and other products. Before they're sold in international markets, the hides are visually inspected, weighed, and given a numeric grade based on the quality of the hide. Hides with defects caused from insect bites, abrasions, scars, and natural rough spots, they'll get a lower grade compared to hides in premium condition.
One of the interesting things about leather is that it's probably the first manufacturing process that was ever developed, and it continued to develop over centuries in an empirical fashion. Up to the present day, the main way for deciding what the quality of a hide was and what the quality of the leather you would get from that hide was by looking at it.
The problem with evaluating hides is the defects often appear on the skin below the hairs, which aren't removed until later in the leather making process. So it's often a guessing game as to trying to determine the quality of the hide. And Brown noted that while one person would rate as high quality, another would rate as low quality. There was no uniform rating system.
Everybody's got a different idea of what they would like. Usually they took the fat off the bottom before they did the inspection, but they didn't take the hair off. So if you have hair on it, you can't see insect bites, you can't see scratches or any of those things.
ARS research materials engineer Dr. Chen Kung Liu and his team created an automated, objective method for detecting imperfections on a hide, a method that would greatly benefit U.S. leather producers.
This would improve the ability to grade the hides and decide which hides were appropriate for which application. And since most of the hides are exported, it would also affect the price significantly. So that's where this started.
The technique involved examining the hide without removing the cattle hair using airborne ultrasonics. Airborne ultrasonics is often used in the lumber industry to detect which materials had internal defects, such as internal decaying or internal rot. It's also used to grade the lumber before it goes to the mills.
The idea was that if it worked for something like that, which was looking at large pieces of material and being able to see things which you couldn't see otherwise, that it was worth trying with the leather. And they actually were able to do large pieces of hide. A hide is pretty big, maybe 6 by 4 feet. They're big. And running a scan above and below a piece of leather on both sides of it, they were able to pick up places where there were hot spots, and they could pick out spots which had problems.
The technique involved pulsing ultrasound or ultrasonic beams at the leather and then measuring the reflected and transmitted portions of the beam. By looking at the differences between the measurements, they could pick out which hide pieces had the most and least imperfections, which could affect their grade quality. Of course, pulsing ultrasonic beams at a soft cattle hide might be expected to damage the hide, especially at levels used to test timber. ARS researchers tested different pulsing rates and frequency until they found a test condition that provided accurate results as to the quality of the hide.
What was determined was if you used a low resonance pulse, you got better results on the hide because it's a softer material than the wood. So it's a matter of tuning it to get the appropriate balance.
The beauty of this technology is it could be done early in the leather manufacturing process, which can be time-consuming and costly. The leather industry could now determine the quality of their hides before spending time and effort turning the raw materials into fine leather for purses, wallets, or jackets, or other leather products such as car seats, couches, and handbags.
And problems can show up even later in the processing. It may not be at the first stage. So the more information you have going in, the better off you're going to be eventually.
Let's get back to the technology itself. When I think of ultrasound, I think of an imaging system used to monitor the growth and development of a fetus. But did you know that ultrasound is also used for cleaning various materials, like electronics, cables, and wires? For cleaning purposes, it uses high-frequency, high-intensity sound waves submerged in a liquid to help remove foreign contaminants from surfaces.
And it's nice because you're not applying any chemicals, you're not applying any other hazards or anything to it. Sounds like it's kind of almost a natural process.
Right. It's often done in solution, but it's a non-destructive way to do the testing.
Liu's quality testing method drew interest from the leather industry, but that wasn't the only accomplishment in this area. As I mentioned before, turning hides into leather could be a lengthy and expensive process, typically involving many stages, such as dehairing, tanning, and finishing. Even today, different parts of these stages require manual labor.
The work I did was on trying to understand the mechanisms for converting the hide into leather, and collagen being the primary component, studying how collagen reacted to various tanning processes, because there were pushes from different parts of the market to develop leathers which did not use chromium. Primary tanning agent for the past 125-30 years has been chromium, but it's chrome 3, it's not toxic.
There are basically three ways for tanning leather. Centuries ago, manufacturers used extracts from tree bark or leaves of trees in the tanning process. Back in the 1960s, use of organic tannages became popular, which are primarily based on aldehydes. Today, leather manufacturers often use chromium 3 as the primary tanning agent because it's cost-friendly and effective.
There was always a concern that some of it could become oxidized and become chrome 6, which is toxic and which is a problem in the environment generally.
Leather manufacturers were concerned that during the waste treatment process, chrome 3 could potentially become oxidized and turn into chrome 6. Chromium is a natural element that is present in the environment, like in rocks, animals, plants, soil, and gases. According to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, chrome 3 is an essential trace element in humans, but chronic exposure may be harmful. Chrome 6 poses an occupational safety and health concern because of its extreme toxicity and designation as a human carcinogen. Researchers found that chrome 3 was not oxidized during the tanning process. Brown noted that modern tanneries have built-in controls that prevent the oxidation of chromium in the waste stream, further protecting their workers and the environment. If you want to hear more about our research on leather processing, make sure to check out our upcoming podcast on sports and science. In that episode, we dive into how researchers develop new, environmentally friendly ways to turn cattle hides into leather while ensuring better quality products such as baseball and boxing gloves, athletic shoes, and footballs. Stay tuned. When it comes to diversity, perhaps no plant has much potential as hemp, which is kind of weird to say that hemp has so much potential because it's been around for thousands of years.
There is a deep and rich history of hemp across many cultures. I think the oldest archaeological evidence that's confirmed of hemp was 8,000 BC, so 10,000 years old. It feels like a new crop to us in a lot of ways, but people would laugh from prior times because it's been with humans for a really long time.
That's Dr. Zachary Stansel, a germplasm curator at the Plant Genetic Resources Unit in Geneva, New York. He leads ARS's research on hemp germplasm preservation and cultivar development. Hemp's connection to this country is, well, tricky. It was considered an important crop in colonial times for its diverse uses, not only clothing, but for paper, seed oil, and medicines. In the 1930s, the Ford Motor Company operated a biomass conversion plant that processed ethanol from hemp and developed car parts constructed from hemp. In fact, if you look on the back of a $10 bill from the early 1900s, you'll see an image of farmers harvesting hemp. Hemp production in the U.S. was banned in 1937, mainly due to its genealogy as a cannabis plant, which we'll dive more into later. It wasn't until 2018, nearly 90 years later, that Congress reauthorized the production of hemp, giving farmers across the nation a new crop to grow.
One of the coolest things about hemp is it's used for so many different things, but that also can make it overwhelming and a complex problem. I think that for hemp to be successful, we'll use all of the parts of the plant. So we've been mostly talking about the fiber, the outer layer of the plant. Inside of the plant is the herd. It tends to be more woody. Can a farmer grow a field of hemp, harvest the fiber out, but also sell the herd as an off product?
Hemp has long been used for fiber and grains, but researchers are exploring applications for biofuel, sustainable building materials, carbon sequestration, and even nanotechnology. A lot of applications indeed, but for this episode, we're talking about wearable science. And hemp could have a huge impact on clothing and other textiles. I spoke with Dr. Heather Grab about the advantages hemp has over other clothing materials. Grab is a senior lecturer at Cornell University's School of Integrative Plant Sciences.
There's a really long history of using hemp, particularly because it has very long fibers with high tensile strength. So that means it's a much more durable natural fiber compared to other alternatives that are out there. Some of the benefits relative to cotton, for example, is that hemp can be grown in a much wider geographic area than cotton can. It often uses lower levels of water inputs. And at the moment, there are very few big pests that dramatically threaten those crops. We're not applying pesticides to this crop at a very broad scale, in contrast to some of the other natural fibers that are out there.
Yield is also a big benefit. Hemp plants can not only grow fast, but tall, like up to 20 feet tall. And as Stansell mentioned, they're finding the entire plant has market potential. Even its inner woody core, called the herd, which is already being used in animal bedding.
Will hemp prove to be this new widespread crop that kind of takes its place in the pantheon of corn and soybean and canola? Or will it be this kind of minor niche specialty crop? I don't think we really know until we give the plant a fair shake.
Equal to its potential are the challenges of growing hemp under the current regulations for THC levels. Because hemp is a cannabis plant, it may carry high levels of THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, a chemical within the plant that could have psychoactive effects on humans. Hemp also contains high levels of cannabidiol, or CBD, a chemical that typically does not have psychoactive effects. Current regulations stipulate that hemp plants must produce THC levels below 0.3% to be legally grown. But how can you find that out before you start growing the plant? That's what growers want to know.
THC and CBD are actually extremely similar molecules. They just kind of differ by a few small bonds. And yes, they have pretty profound psychological differences on people. Some of the work done at Cornell University and other places has done a really nice job of taking apart that biosynthetic mechanism that says this particular plant is really going to shift a lot of its energy into producing a lot of THC or shift a lot of energy into producing CBD. In conjunction with that, we have these really fantastic tools called molecular markers, where we can take a plant that has recently germinated, just a few leaves, get the DNA out, and then use these molecular marker tools to say, this plant is going to have extremely high THC or very low THC.
Stansell and his team are using these molecular markers to help plant breeders select and develop hemp varieties that will be low in THC. They have gathered hemp seeds from all over the world to create this huge germplasm repository. With such a mass selection of diverse seeds, breeders can select the most advantageous traits to create new varieties of hemp that increase its appeal for growers and in the marketplace.
Think about tomatoes. Tomatoes were domesticated from wild plants in the Andes, and they're very small, maybe the size of a marble. Some of them were poisonous, and they didn't really taste good. Over time, formal academic people and small gardeners have made selections on that germplasm to produce these larger, more delicious, more agronomically successful varieties of tomatoes. So one thing that's really exciting with hemp is we're at kind of in the early stage of formally breeding these well-adapted, locally adapted types of hemp that will meet all these needs and produce extremely high quality products. Having a library of diverse hemp germplasm is this critical first step that allows the breeders, the researchers, and ultimately the farmers to be successful at producing hemp.
Researchers are also finding that hemp provides environmental benefits as a pollinator resource, especially during times of the year when pollinator flowers are often dormant.
If you go into a hemp field in the middle of the summer, it'll be buzzing with insects, and many of those are bees. And that's a period of time, especially in agricultural landscapes, where there's very few other floral resources that are available to those pollinators. And so that could provide a key support for insect populations that go on to provide important ecosystem services in other high-value specialty crops surrounding farms that are growing hemp.
As Stancil mentioned earlier, hemp success really depends on two main factors. It has to be able to be grown efficiently, and there has to be a diverse marketplace interested in the crop. Stancil likens it to cotton, which has greatly expanded its usage beyond clothing.
In the case of cotton, that was a really big breakthrough where, yes, you're getting the cotton fibers, but it turns out that the seeds are rich in cottonseed oil. And that became sort of the difference between growing a profitable crop of cotton versus a non-profitable, is having that little bit of cottonseed oil. It kind of made the difference for cotton farmers to be successful. So kind of finding applications for this herd tissue or this herd material as an input into industrial processes, I think, is going to be critical.
Stancil and Grab are cautiously optimistic on their future outlook for hemp. While its potential is fruitful, these challenges have to be addressed before this new or old plant can truly be called a wonder plant.
A lot of our expansion of acreage in the U.S. over the past several years that we've had a federally legal hemp program has been with high cannabinoid hemp production. But I do think we've kind of gotten over the wave of cannabinoids. And now I'm hoping that we'll see, as we build our processing capacity, especially on the fiber side, that we'll continue to see growth and expansion in the industrial side of the market.
Yes, consumers are certainly shifting to prefer natural fibers over synthetic ones, but it's in that space. There's cotton, there's wool, there's flax. What place will hemp fit in there? This is a complex problem that's going to take a lot of time, a lot of research. And then supply chains are often chicken and egg problems, where farmers won't grow hemp until they're confident that they can sell it to a processor. And then processors may not want to invest millions of dollars of infrastructure until they're confident they can buy it, right? So I think those kind of problems can be addressed by the USDA and other organizations to help kind of build up the inertia on a crop like hemp. We have this opportunity to do some extremely exciting research on a crop that has a phenomenal amount of potential.
Thank you for listening to this comfy, cozy, wearable episode of Science in Your Shopping Cart. And stay tuned for our next episode, which weaves agricultural science with sports and athletics. It's a game winner for sure. For Science in Your Shopping Cart, I'm Todd Zeller.
Science in Your Shopping Cart is produced by the Office of Communications, Agricultural Research Service, an agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. For more information, visit www.ars.usda.gov. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Like us on Facebook, and watch us on YouTube.